Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to CLS Year-End Review Teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode, and we will open up for your questions following the prepared remarks. If you wish to ask a question at that time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Carol Gregory to begin. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Maria, and thank you everybody who's joining us by phone, but also people who have logged in to Facebook to join us on our Facebook Live broadcast. I think it's a very important teleconference to end 2017. This has been an unprecedented year, and we really want to talk about some of the progress, how we're moving forward during a Trump administration. And for that conversation, we have our advocates that are on the front line of our work, Deanna Moran, who is our Director of Environmental Planning, our fearless leader, our President of Conservation Law Foundation, Brad Campbell, and Tom Irwin, who is the Director of CLS in New Hampshire and does a lot of our clean water, clean energy work, and just about everything else. So let's just talk about this last year. What have been the biggest challenges, and for all of you, what are the opportunities?
Well, I think the biggest challenge, obviously, is coming from Washington at this point. Everyone, I think, is familiar with the fact that Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord. But it's even worse than that in the sense that he's adopting rules or proposing rules that would take us backwards in many areas. And, for example, a recent rule by Trump's Department of Energy would actually prop up coal plants, require consumers to subsidize coal plants that are otherwise economic and would shut down. That means not just more pollution and more greenhouse gases, it also means more mercury in the atmosphere in many cases, a potent public health threat. So on that side of the ledger, we have a lot of new challenges and are playing a lot more defense. On the positive side, the president's message, and particularly his withdrawal from Paris, has had a galvanizing effect. New governors stepping up and saying, we're still in the Paris Agreement. Cities stepping up and saying, we're going to reach carbon neutrality, and like the city of Boston just did. And so there's kind of both a good news story and a bad news story, and it directly affects our work in many ways. Tom had a hard-fought battle to force the divestiture of coal plants in New Hampshire, the very types of plants that Trump is now trying to prop up.
I guess a few sort of large-scale distressing things that we're seeing out of the administration are obviously its outright rejection of science and the its efforts to essentially gut key agency programs and agency resources. So, for example, over the years we've seen attrition of enforcement capacity at the Environmental Protection Agency. That can only get worse under the trends that we're seeing, under the rhetoric we're seeing from the Trump administration. And I think all of that really elevates the importance of the work CLF does, enforcing our federal environmental laws and injecting sound science into regulatory decision-making.
In one case, the Trump administration actually reversed a penalty that EPA had levied against a polluter, made it a zero penalty, and then gave them a grant to do the compliance they should have done years ago. And so it's a very, very troublesome period.
And I think one of the things, Deanna, I'm sorry, did you want to?
I was just going to echo Tom and Brad's comments and say that I think the silver lining is the federal government taking a step back from these efforts has put new urgency on state and local governments to step up, and they've done that.
So we're talking about the president election, but we also had some elections here in New England, and New Hampshire being one of them. You have a new governor. Tom, give us your sense on Governor Sununu and his environmental record.
Well, we were very disappointed by Governor Sununu's position that he stands with Trump in terms of the president's decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord. We're disappointed that Governor Sununu has not gone the way of Massachusetts, Vermont, Rhode Island, Connecticut in joining the U.S. Climate Alliance and stepping up and leading on the issue of climate change. We also are disappointed with the governor's position supporting the Northern Pass Transmission Project. This is a project that would transmit hydroelectricity from Canada, tearing up much of New Hampshire's landscape in the process. He's also sent troubling signals that we need to rely more on natural gas. So all of that is troubling. On the plus side, we were pleased that the governor recommitted to the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, stayed with that program, and agreed to strengthening that program in terms of reducing emissions from power plants over time. He recently reopened New Hampshire's 10-year energy strategy. So we see that as an opportunity that we hope he will seize to advance a clean energy economy in New Hampshire, and we're certainly mobilizing New Hampshire citizens, residents who care about this issue, and many of them do, and want to see the governor doing the right thing.
I know you, Brad, you talked a bit about, because we also have a new governor in Vermont, so that some people automatically think that you have a new Republican governor coming in, that means anti-environment, and that's actually not the case.
No, we've been very impressed with Governor Scott in Vermont so far. Two major things we didn't expect. One, that he is in the Climate Alliance, meaning he's among the governors who says we're still going to stay on the path, the decarbonization path defined by Paris. And secondly, one of the things that's been needed for a long time is adequate funding to clean up Lake Champlain. And at least for the next 2 years, the governor's made sure that that funding will be in place. And that's a major win. It's a reflection of a lot of work by our Lake Champlain keeper in Vermont and the head of our water program, Chris Killian. But we needed the governor to act, and he did.
And can you talk a little bit about what's happening in, with Governor Baker in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, it's an interesting set of circumstances where after CLF won really two major climate lawsuits, the first requiring economy-wide declining carbon caps and the other essentially outlawing the subsidies that the administration was proposing for new natural gas pipelines, there's been, in our view, a little bit of a turning of the ship in terms of working with CLF and other groups to produce rules that we think will actually meet the targets for reductions by 2020. Those rules are now being challenged by industry, but we're fully confident they'll go into effect. Moving forward with a good resilience program, which Deanna can talk a little bit about, and also not trying to overturn the decision on subsidizing those new gas pipelines, but standing by the court's decision and not seeking legislation to resurrect their original proposal. That means less gas infrastructure, and that means we'll be more likely to stay on the path to decarbonization. But Deanna, do you want to talk a little bit about what's happening with the Baker administration resilience?
Yeah, so in September 2016, Governor Baker passed an executive order on climate mitigation and adaptation. It was Massachusetts' first adaptation-focused executive order, and it really set the stage for a lot of progressive programs in Massachusetts. It requires the state to put together a statewide climate adaptation plan, which they've taken an additional step to integrate into their FEMA-required natural hazard mitigation plan. We're one of a handful of states in the country that have taken that extra step. They've also set up a municipal vulnerability preparedness program for all of Massachusetts cities and towns to provide them with the technical assistance and the expertise that they need to do their own vulnerability assessments and start doing climate adaptation planning. And they've really set themselves up to enable those cities and towns to move into implementation and provide them with technical assistance grants to start doing pilot projects and adaptation work on the ground.
I just want to remind people, and I want to ask you a few more questions about that. I just want to remind people that we are going to be opening up the line for questions. So if you're on Facebook Live, please start typing your questions in. If you're on the phone, you hit *1, and when we go to questions, we'll get you in the queue. So I want to talk a little bit because 2017, when the Trump administration came in, he took climate change off of the website. There was a lot of talk of the climate deniers. And yet this year we had, so many extreme weather events, mm-hmm. and we really discovered so many communities that were really ill-prepared to handle those. How do you think New England would fare something similar, and do you think this is changing the conversation around climate adaptation and climate resiliency?
Yeah, so a lot of New England states have really stepped up on climate adaptation and emergency response. Massachusetts has definitely come to the forefront as a leader among in New England states on that. As I mentioned, the framework set up by Governor Baker's executive order was really a driving force behind that. But at the same time, a lot of those efforts have stalled in the research and data collection phase, and we haven't seen a lot happen on the ground. And a really good example is Boston, where we have a mountain of research that really has laid out a roadmap for us of what we need to do. And in practice, we just haven't gotten there. And so the answer is no, we're not ready, but we know what we need to do to get ready. And so that's really been CLF's focus, is pushing those implementation efforts. And, you know, today in any New England state, if we were to get a Hurricane Harvey, a Hurricane Sandy, or even a storm with half the intensity of those storms, there would be very serious consequences, public health consequences, consequences on our infrastructure. And, you know, as we saw with the hurricanes in this past season, they have really long-term impacts on people, on the environment, and to really get ready and prepare our communities for those impacts, we need to start thinking about how we implement climate-resilient standards and codes for development, how we make sure that our public utilities are prepared and they're thinking about climate change. And we really haven't seen that shift yet in long-term land use and planning decisions to have that climate frame. But I think there's a lot of opportunity to get there. I think that people see, can really resonate with things like wildfires and droughts and hurricanes because they impact them directly. And even if, you know, they don't believe that there's a climate change factor, they know that those things are happening and they're happening more often because they see it. And so it's a lot easier to kind of mobilize people around the idea of emergency preparedness and climate adaptation planning than it is in some of our other areas of work. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there.
We're also seeing kind of a division in the regulated community, I think. There are companies like GE that have opened a dialogue with us to make sure they were doing the right thing on resilience. And on the other hand, there are developers who were fighting in court because their projects don't take into account the need for resilience, the need for an adequate public realm. We really think we need more of that kind of corporate leadership in order to stay on the Paris path, to avoid catastrophic circumstances. We have $6 billion of new construction going on in the seaport right now. Probably 5% of it is designed in a way that ensures resilience. So we're in a sense building toward disaster if the modeling, the data, and the, you know, analysis that the cities and states are producing doesn't get turned into tougher codes and regulations.
And one of the, you know, the communities, of course, that bear the brunt of this are sometimes our most vulnerable communities, as is the case with one of the litigation that we've filed against ExxonMobil for an oil storage facility that would not withstand even a small storm could put those people at risk. Could you tell us a bit about that case and where it is right now?
Yeah, our ExxonMobil case concerns an ExxonMobil terminal in Chelsea, right on Chelsea Creek, which is a tributary to Mystic River in Boston Harbor. I think most people know that one of CLF's legacy achievements was to force the cleanup of Boston Harbor. That investment and the public investment of billions of dollars is now at risk because ExxonMobil is not complying with its permits and not making the changes to its facility that are needed in order to address climate impacts. And those climate impacts include not just the types of storms that Deanna was talking about, but the more than 70% increase in intense rains that we're getting, you know, when you get more than 2 inches of rain over a 24-hour period. Because every drop of water that hits that facility has to be treated, that treatment facility is already being overwhelmed, resulting in many self-reported violations by Exxon that are being recorded at EPA, but on which EPA, neither under Obama nor under Trump, has taken action. And so that's why we brought our citizenship suit. And it's among the reasons why when Exxon tried to dismiss that suit earlier this year, Judge Wolf ruled that we had made the case that there are current and imminent conditions being caused by climate change that need to be heard.
And I'm just going to ask, I just want to remind people that we are going to be taking questions. I'm going to actually ask Our digital communication strategist is off screen right now. Why I can't see the Facebook Live, so I can see the questions, if you don't mind coming over real quick and showing me.
There's no questions on Facebook Live yet.
Oh, okay. I just don't even see the thing on there. That's what I was asking you to. Sorry. If you can just check that out for me, I'd really appreciate it. So, you know, we've been seeing a lot around, you know, constantly all these EPA rollbacks. I want to talk a bit about the clean water work and what that impact might be on the clean water work that we're doing.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the major threats to our water resources throughout New England is stormwater pollution. We see, you know, a host of pollutants running off paved surfaces. And so the more low-density development we have, the more stormwater pollution we have, and that is taking a real toll on rivers, streams, bays, lakes throughout the region. So, you know, one of the actions we're involved in right now relates to a stormwater permit issued by EPA to regulate municipalities, many in Massachusetts and many in New Hampshire. We're very concerned that EPA is not addressing this problem to the extent they need to be. And so we've actually challenged both the New Hampshire and Massachusetts municipal stormwater permits. On the other side of our case, there's a group called the Center for Regulatory Reasonableness, and their position is basically the EPA has no role to play in doing what they're doing on stormwater pollution. So there is work to be done across the region. We think the EPA needs to step up and play a stronger role on a host of water-related issues, but certainly, you know, these are two examples of permits with far-reaching effects.
But I think it's important to note that we had lawsuits pending against EPA for this type of pollution during the Obama administration. There were areas where, throughout that administration, there were new health threats that were not seeing any response. For example, Tom is dealing at the former Pease Air Force Base at the Coakley Landfill with these Teflon-related contaminants, the perfluorochemicals. EPA hasn't set a standard for those. They didn't do it after 8 years of Obama. They're certainly not going to do it in the current administration. And that's where CLF's advocacy becomes crucial, because unless we're there pushing and using the legal tools we have with legislators like Mindy Mesmer in New Hampshire, who's been a great advocate on this issue, nothing happens. And that's something where our battle is very much the same before the election and after the election.
And back to that theme we were discussing before with climate, with states stepping up where the federal government is not performing on the issue of perfluorinated chemicals, you know, EPA has not been doing the job. So certain states are leading the way. Vermont has a very aggressive standard for protecting people from perfluorinated chemicals, New Jersey as well. So there are states that are moving forward. So we really need the states to play an important role here as well. And, you know, Brad mentioned Representative Mesmer. She pushed legislation in the New Hampshire legislature on this very issue of more stringent standards to protect drinking water and groundwater resources from perfluorinated chemicals. I think that battle will continue.
You know, one thing, we're talking about the EPA. Brad, you and I had attended an event where Gina McCarthy was speaking on a panel, and she referenced the fact that the EPA is, in fact, a public health agency. And I thought that was interesting, because I've often heard you say that, you know, the environment really needs to, and public health go hand in hand, and we really need to reframe how we talk about the environment. Can you just touch on what you meant by that?
Well, you know, most of our federal and state environmental statutes are actually drawn in terms of protecting public health first and foremost. And what we're seeing is many of the environmental threats that we're battling in New England have a direct nexus to very serious public health impacts. And I'll just name a couple. First, these perfluorochemicals that Tom mentioned at Pease Air Force Base, Coakley Landfill, those are connected to a range of adverse health effects, including certain cancers, and yet there are no standards for them. The blue-green algae blooms that are proliferating everywhere from Lake Champlain to Rhode Island produce a neurotoxin that's linked to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and Parkinson's. And even in the context of greenhouse gases, what we're now understanding is that, and I thank one of our supporters, Loretta Mickley, who presented on this recently, the warming of the atmosphere is also going to mean a return to soot and smog that have impacts in terms of respiratory diseases, childhood asthma, which is already an epidemic. So in all of the areas that where CLF is working, there's a direct public health issue as well as an environmental issue.
I just want to remind people we're going to be opening up the lines soon for questions. So if you have a question, if you're on the phone, hit *1. And on Facebook, just, you know, type in your comments, which I think people are having a little bit of an audio issue. I don't know if that's been fixed or not, but I do apologize for that. Hopefully you're able to hear us now.
And while we're waiting for questions, just let me mention two. I've been taught there are no silver linings currently, but at least some bronze linings. One is that we've had a tremendous response in terms of our members and supporters, in terms of stepping forward and helping us in these battles. And one unexpected surprise was that the regional administrator of EPA, appointed by the Trump administration, is someone who's very well qualified, very thoughtful, very, very much a professional, and we're hoping that that will be a good working relationship, even though we will inevitably disagree on a number of issues.
Okay, and I understand that we were having some technical issues on Facebook Live, and I really do apologize for folks that had joined us there, and we'll send a message out, or send a link out maybe so that you can hear the rest of this broadcast. But for those on the phone, still welcome to bring those questions in. Just hit *1, and we'll start getting you in the line for those questions because we really do want to hear from you. I want to talk a little bit about what's going to be coming up. You know, what do you see as the big, opportunities for 2018?
Well, you know, I think that there have been some great aspirational things said, markers put down in terms of carbon neutrality and decarbonization. I think in the next couple of years we're going to see, how various elected officials put the meat on those bones and whether they actually walk the walk. For example, we had a very good working relationship with Secretary Beaton here in Massachusetts on the carbon rules for the first round of carbon rules. They now have to come forward with what the target is for 2030 and 2040 and how they're going to get there. And in areas like transportation, that's going to be a very difficult challenge, and it's going to take some political courage and some political will. So that's an area where we're looking to see opportunity for us to model the right approaches, but also challenges in terms of getting them to do the right thing.
Deanna, Tom, either of you, what do you see as some big opportunities for 2018?
So as we kind of talked about, you know, with everything that's happening with the hurricane seasons and the wildfires, I think there's a real opportunity to move forward on adaptation, especially with the private sector coming to the realization that adaptation is in their best interest. In the long term, being prepared for climate now saves millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, in recovery and reconstruction later. And so we've really seen the private sector step up and come to the table on this and be willing to do, you know, what the administration can't do in terms of, you know, designing better. And, you know, as Brad had mentioned, corporate leadership is huge in the interim before we have those standards and regulations. And we've seen a lot of companies like GE really take a first step there.
I also should mention that the looming tax bill, should it be passed, is likely to have devastating consequences for our work in a couple of different areas. For example, many renewable projects, and as a former solar developer, I know this well, are driven by the investment tax credits that are generated by building a solar project or the production tax credit that's generated by building wind projects. Essentially, through the changes in corporate tax rates, the appetite for those credits nationally is going to dry up or significantly diminish, depending on what the final form of that bill looks like. That's really going to hurt the pace of renewables development if that's actually passed. Another area is low-income housing tax credits, which are and historic preservation tax credits, which are a key element of the financing of our Healthy Neighborhoods Equity Program, Equity Fund, if that corporate appetite for those tax credits dries up in that area, it's going to be that much harder to help support healthy redevelopment projects in distressed areas. So we're looking at that tax bill with a wary eye and are anticipating that there'll be some significant adverse consequences for us.
Is there anything we can do in terms of, you know, the tax bill? It's pretty daunting, and you know, there are some things that can impact the work that we're doing. How can people get involved in that, because they're reconciling that right now?
Well, I think it remains to be seen if, the only place that will likely be defeated is the Senate. I know that a lot of our members in Maine are actively pressing on Senator Collins to change her vote on that issue. I think if a few other votes change, it could be an important shift that would allow the tax bill to be defeated or at least significantly reformed. But to date, we're not optimistic. And I think keeping pressure on Senator Collins in the hope that her exhibiting some courage will lead some of the other swing Republicans like Senator McCain or Jeff Flake to do the right thing. And as Senator McCain has said, return to regular order, which means really trying to do things on a bipartisan basis. That's the hope that we have. And so I thank our members in Maine who've been very active there.
And I don't want to lose the opportunity for you to talk about, what's coming up in the next year and where those big opportunities or those big battles are going to be.
Well, I think circling back to the discussion about public health, one thing I'll mention is fortunately, we're seeing more and more positive attention given to the problem of childhood lead poisoning. We are on the cusp of getting strong legislation passed in New Hampshire to greatly strengthen our current laws. And, I want to emphasize that has been a great bipartisan effort.
Scott Pruitt is saying he's calling a war on lead now.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, at the EPA level, we've heard Scott Pruitt say that, declaring war on lead. It remains to be seen what that means. Hopefully that means, better regulations, more stringent standards on water quality, for example. The federal standard for drinking water and lead is far too high. Right now in Massachusetts, there's actually legislation being moved forward to push that level down to one part per billion for schools. The EPA standard is 15 parts per billion. And when you consider that there is no safe level of lead exposure, particularly for kids, that's a problem. And it's certainly something we need strong improvement on. So good progress being made there.
And some countervailing setbacks. I mean, there's a certain hypocrisy to me of Administrator Pruitt saying, making lead poisoning a priority when they are loosening the rules that control exposure to mercury,
mm-hmm.
Which is another neurotoxin, also highly impacting expectant mothers and early childhood, just the way same mechanism as lead, and one that really affects some of the things we most treasure about New England. It limits, for example, the number of certain fish you can take because of the bioaccumulation of mercury in those fish. And so it's very difficult to take at face value the administration's commitments or stated commitments on lead when they're undoing a critical public health protection with the other hand.
And it does remain to be seen what exactly they mean by declaring war on lead, if it means anything or if it's rhetoric. But we're seeing at the state level really good bipartisan cooperation on this issue, and that's been refreshing to see.
I know one of the things that, and I'm really surprised, I don't see any questions in the queue yet, so I just want to remind everybody, star one, and I'm looking at who's on the phone, so I'm surprised you folks aren't asking questions, but I'm just going to keep talking. So,
surprise.
That's a big surprise. But I know one of the things that really kind of freaked me out was in that first month, it just seemed that the President Trump was just signing, you know, just all these executive orders that seemed to be rolling back everything. But it's really not that easy just to sign an executive order. And I just, Brad, you talked a little bit about that when it was first happening, that there are some rules in place that you just can't sign a pen away and it all goes away. So there's still a lot of room for us to fight.
Yeah, there is room to fight. In general, it takes a new rule to revoke an old rule. And the president can't just issue an executive order to make a rule go away, although they have tried. And they're also using the fact that some rules were already in litigation, some of the Obama-era rules were already in court, to see if they can use the court process to say, oh, well, court, just send it back to us because we're going to redo the rule anyway. So there's some gaming going on there, but as a general matter, they need to follow a legal process. And just as they've been cavalier and dismissive about sound science, they've also been fairly cavalier and dismissive about the legal requirements that are necessary to change standards and protections that have been in place. And that creates, I think, an opening for groups like CLF to try to keep those rules in place and to combat some of the rollbacks.
It feels like it's such a politically divided country right now, like I've never seen before. Is there an issue? Where can we reach across the aisle and get some agreement, do you think? And I want all of you to touch on that.
Well, you know, I think the partisanship is mostly in Washington, and we're seeing much more bipartisanship in the New England region in particular, because everyone's united about the values and the resources that we treasure here in New England. We're seeing two Republican governors in New England join the Climate Alliance, but we're not seeing that elsewhere in the country. There's still a terrible partisan divide, and one of the problems is that it really constrains what's happening in Washington really constrains some of the people who would otherwise be leaders on these issues, either because they don't have support across the aisle or because they're not, can't get too far ahead or be too oppositional to the party and to their party leadership. So it's definitely having a dampening effect, but this has always been a bipartisan issue. Some of the greatest Republican leaders on the environment, people like John Chafee of Rhode Island, who chaired the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee for many years. There's really a bipartisan tradition in New England, and we think that may be strengthening a little bit, coming back a little bit in response to the Trump phenomenon.
Dan or Tom, do you have any thoughts on that, on where we could find some area where you think we could get some?
Well, I think one point I'd like to make is that a lot of what might be perceived as divisiveness on some of these issues, certainly as they're playing out in our state legislatures, are actually divisions being created by corporate interests from afar. For example, the Koch brothers have lots of money flowing into New Hampshire to certain groups that are working hard to dismantle existing clean energy laws, to force New Hampshire to exit the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, to undo or greatly weaken our clean and renewable energy programs. And I think what's essential is that people engage, and I think it's easier in New England with our legislatures for people to access their legislators and have an impact. Because I think if people at the local level are reaching out to their representatives, their senators, it'll be much more difficult for those decision makers to be beholden to Koch-funded groups.
I think the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that Tom mentioned is an important example of the kind of bipartisanship that is surviving at the regional level. That initiative was started a decade ago. Some states have come and gone, but it has held. New Jersey plans to return, and the states, the bipartisan group of states that are in REGI, did two things this year that are significant. One is they tightened the cap by 30%. And second, they agreed to look at how that same mechanism might be used to control emissions from transportation. And those are both big deals, and both steps forward that are happening at the regional level in spite of what's happening in Washington.
I believe we have, oh no, he just left the queue. So I'm sorry about that, Brad. I guess I didn't get to you, but we do have another question here about looking at the 2018 elections. Do you see an opportunity to make progress on environmental issues that have been stalled in recent years?
Well, obviously that's going to depend on how dramatic the change is in Congress, and there are lots of predictions either way. Obviously, the election this past week of Doug Jones in Alabama sends one signal, but it's a pretty tough road for there to be a wholesale changeover in the Congress. But, you know, from my perspective, and having spent over a decade in Washington, it's just as important that there be more candidates of either party at the center who are able to reach across the aisle and fewer at the extremes. And, you know, the hope is that we'll get that some of the special elections and some of the areas where President Trump is unpopular, getting unfavorable ratings, will maybe push people toward the center. But it's a situation where I think we're going to have to continue to depend on regional and state action to lead the way, because we're undoubtedly going to be on the defensive at the federal level for quite some time. One issue we're looking at now, and where two issues actually that are pending before the Congress. One is the reauthorization of the National Flood Insurance Program, which I think Deanna could speak to. And the other is we're worried about a kind of a midnight reauthorization of the Magnuson Fisheries Act, because there's a lot of mischief that could happen in the context of reauthorizing that bill through a process that's not transparent and open. But I don't know if you want to speak to what's happening with the NFIP.
Yeah, sure. So the Federal National Flood Insurance Program, which anybody who, you know, has a home in a floodplain and was required to get an insurance policy knows, you know, what that program is about. But it has to be reauthorized by Congress every 4 or 5 years, and it was up for reauthorization this past September. Congress extended the reauthorization period until the end of this month, and it doesn't look like they've made any progress on reforming and reauthorizing that program, so it'll likely be extended again. But our hope, prior to the Trump administration coming in, was that with that reauthorization process coming up, we would have an opportunity to pass some really meaningful reforms. One of the things that program does not do is consider climate change at all. And so one of the things that became really evident with Hurricane Harvey was you had a lot of homeowners who were told that they were not in the floodplain who were flooded, and they were completely unprepared for that type of flooding. And it's partly the fault of the program for not acknowledging that the floodplains that we've always had are expanding, and that we can no longer rely on historical data to determine who's at risk and who's not. And one of our hopes is that in reforming the National Flood Insurance Program before reauthorizing it, we can start to incorporate some of those principles. And when we do our floodplain mapping, we can tell people that you might not be in the floodplain now, but you're going to be in the floodplain, you know, in the next 10, 20 years. It's particularly important for people who are looking at long-term 30-year mortgages, because even if the day that they go to buy their mortgage, they're not considered to be in the floodplain, if they're on the edge of it, they're going to be in the floodplain sooner or later. And we need some more, standards in place that prevent development and prevent people from getting around kind of what the framework that's already in place. A really good example is in Houston. There was an entire community where the developer basically put down extra dirt and soil to elevate his plot of land about half an inch above the federal floodplain. So he was taken out of the federal floodplain, and everyone who purchased a home in that development was told they didn't need flood insurance, when in reality, they absolutely did need flood insurance because they used to be in a floodplain and they were on the absolute edge of a floodplain. From a homeowner's perspective, changes to that program are going to be huge and something that we really need to push forward on.
Wow.
One of the frustrations is that at the state and local level, there's often better data available than the federal flood insurance maps, which don't take into account climate change.
Right.
And one of the things we need to do is change the practice of engineers, architects, as well as regulators to look at what the science is telling us.
I just want to, we do have a couple of questions I want to make sure we get to. From one is, can you comment on the progress and chances of success for the Transportation Climate Initiative as a means of addressing emissions from transportation sector?
Yes, this is a, the Transportation Climate Initiative is really an effort launched out of Georgetown University, and Massachusetts has been engaged but not fully participating, and the northeastern states have different levels of engagement in it. It's a tough set of problems, and the hope is that some sort of mechanism can be put in place region-wide, much like REGI, that would allow us to begin to curb vehicle miles traveled and the consequent greenhouse gas emissions. And so it's going to take some political courage for, because some of those may include fees or changing the way in which we pay for roads so that we reduce mileage. It's going to take some courage to address those issues, but those issues are going to have to be addressed anyway because we're increasingly going to be in an electrified transportation environment. Road building and road maintenance that depends on gas taxes, that mechanism isn't going to last very long,
right?
And maintain our infrastructure. So I think there'll be opportunities, and I would say there's a strong chance of success, but that it's a multi-year process. It's not going to happen overnight.
We have a question. We also have a question on the phone here from I'm going to just go with first names. Lucy?
Yes, hi. My question is, since the big polluters, big industries will have a lot more money if this tax plan goes through, how can they possibly argue that they don't have enough money to clean up after themselves? Can't they be embarrassed into putting in pollution controls, since in the past they've always said they'd have to fire workers in order to have enough money to clean up after themselves, but now they're going to have tons of money. Can't we use this sort of as a good argument to make them be more realistic?
Oh, I wish it were so. You know, one of the things we saw is that over the past decade is that during times when the oil and gas industry was extremely profitable, ExxonMobil being for a time the most profitable company in the world, they were also spending $100 million a year or more. I think Bloomberg said it was $115 million in 2015 to undermine climate science, even the very science that their own scientists were saying since the Nixon administration. Those companies had scientists doing good science saying carbon emissions from our product will cause climate change, and that those changes are potentially catastrophic if policy isn't changed. And yet they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to undermine that message, and forcing groups like ours, like CLF, to take them on simply to hold them to what their own science is saying. In other words, look at these climate conditions that you know are coming or are here, and your facility is unprepared. So would that it were so in terms of they're deploying that funding for better purposes. But there is another sense in which capital flows and the resources of major companies are flowing in the right direction. Many companies now are insisting on 100% renewable energy. Many are reducing their carbon footprint or have taken pledges of carbon neutrality. And most, in our region especially, most people are focused on trying to put on the opportunities that the innovation economy will bring as we decarbonize. So the positive side is that hopefully there'll be more funding available for those new technologies and entrepreneurs, especially those in this region. But we're not seeing that as a result of the tax bill?
I think the question, and we're going to be getting pretty close to wrap, and I just want to get some last thoughts from everybody, but one question that we get time and time again, people really want to get involved and they want to know, what can I do? People just don't want to sit on the sidelines. Can you speak to that about how people can get involved in these issues, how people can make a difference and make sure they're part of the conversation?
Well, I think there are a number of ways. Certainly having your legislative officials and especially your state and local elected officials understand that these issues are important to you. You know, if you live in a coastal community, a coastal city like Providence or Boston, your mayors, your governors need to know that these issues are a priority for you, whether it's safety from climate impacts or whether it's the gas leaks that are both a safety and a climate threat that permeate our neighborhoods and that have rallied groups like Mothers Out Front to join CLF in fighting. They need to hear from you. So that's yeah, one major area. Secondly, in order to keep abreast of these issues, sign up for CLF's action alerts. Go to the website, because often there are retail opportunities to weigh in on something that's where a decision by a particular elected official may be hanging in the balance, and you can take action there. And also join our events so that you can learn more about these issues and what the specific opportunities are day by day. And finally, obviously, we all make choices every day as consumers, and to the more we can reinforce the reduced use of fossil fuels, considering electric vehicles, considering either solar or through your utility buying carbon-free electricity, which is possible at only a slight added cost. Those are all ways in which we can all contribute to solving the problem.
And I like what you said, Brad, about the calling on the legislator, because so often I hear people say, well, my person, you know, already cares about these issues, but they really do need to hear. They're hearing from so many different constituents about so many different issues, so it really is vitally important. And Tom, you probably know firsthand, action alerts, you know, it's the power of that phone call and people sending in those, you know, sending in those action alerts. Can you just talk a bit about, you know?
Absolutely. You know. So, yeah, I've had legislators tell me that, you know, people are noticing when CLF members, through an action alert that we've put out, are getting in touch. And obviously, it's a numbers game, so the more people who take advantage of those opportunities, the more effective we are. But it has an impact. It absolutely has an impact.
Yeah, and often it's the things that don't happen that are just as important as those that do. I would never have guessed. Everyone at CLF expected that when we won the lawsuit, knocking out the subsidies for the new and unneeded gas pipelines, that the legislature would overturn it. But they had, by the time we won that decision, they had heard from enough of their constituents that they did not want more big gas infrastructure, that they left the issue alone, let the decision stand. And I think people need to appreciate how effective their voice can be in these contexts.
Okay, thank you. I think that's a good word for us to end on, and I do want to thank everyone who joined us on the phone. I'm sorry, did you have another?
I just want to, as we approach the holiday season and the new year, I just want to say a special thank you to all of you who are have joined CLF or supporting CLF. We can't do this work without you, and I hope for those of you who are new to the phone, you consider taking a look at our website, taking a look at our work, and join the ranks of our great supporters. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. That does conclude today's call. You may now disconnect.